Doctor, you have another tape presentation to share with our audience.
I do, Mike, and one that will help take us into the world of those who have hearing difficulties, and in this case, help us understand those who are profoundly deaf. Sue Thomas cannot hear at all. She was 18 months of age and watching television when she suddenly went deaf. And it took some time for her parents to fully comprehend that. I don't believe they ever diagnosed the reason that she lost her hearing in that way. But she has a message that I think is very moving, and we really need to hear this story on behalf of those who have this particular problem. I do need to give Sue Thomas a little better introduction, Mike. She founded Operation Sound in 1986, which is a nonprofit organization designed to help open the doorway between hearing and deaf worlds. She recently moved Operation Sound to Pomona, California, right here in
our
area. She is a neighbor of ours, and I hope to meet her soon. But for now, Mike, we'll have to rely on tape. Let's hear her story.
Here is Sue Thomas.
I lost my hearing at the age of 18 months due to unknown causes. The story says that I was sitting in front of a television with my parents and my brothers, and it was later in the evening, and I went up and I turned up the sound full blast on the television, and my mother went up and she turned it down, and I turned it up and she turned it down, and I was on my way up to turn it up for the third time when she felt that it was getting late and I was getting tired and it was time to go to bed. My hearing had gone in the split seconds, but it went undetected. My mother nor my father nor my brothers knew that I had gone profoundly deaf at that time. The next morning I woke up and I was not responding to things that would normally excite me. My mother became concerned and she called our neighbor who was a nurse, and our neighbor suggested that she get me to a specialist right away, that she felt something was wrong. Indeed, after my mother took me to the doctor, she expressed those words that would follow me throughout my life. I looked at my mother and she said, "There's no hearing there. It's gone. She's profoundly deaf." From that moment, my parents were met with doctors and educators alike, trying to convince them that the best thing that they could do for me and to the family was to put me in a deaf institution, that I would never be able to learn to speak, that I would never be able to learn, that it would be best on the family. I'm the only girl, and I'm the youngest. And my parents vowed that they wouldn't send me away. And with that vow, they took it upon themselves to give me every best possible chance and every tool that is capable of giving, that I might be able to live and to survive in your world, that of the hearing. I remember very well my father working overtime for his job. He worked on Saturday simply to pay the bills of a therapy that I would need to give me all the lessons and the tools. And while he was working, thus sacrificing the time, my mother spent hours with me in front of a mirror developing my speech. That began a life of frustration, a life of alienation. It began a life that would be torn with strife within spite of me, crying out, fighting, wanting so desperately to understand, wanting so desperately to do it right, only to be told, "Oh, try it again." And those early years, I remember the one thing that calmed me more than anything else was running and sitting on my mother's lap in a rocking chair. My mother held me close, and I put my head on her shoulder, and she began to sing hymns to me. And by having my head on her shoulder, I could feel the vibrations coming from her. And I never forget one of the first songs that she sang, one of the first songs that I learned, was Silent Night. That song has stayed with me my entire life. when I was lonely, so lonely, and when I was frustrated, and when I was on the verge of tears, no matter where I'd be, within sight of me, without any sound, I would be singing Silent Night. Those words were soothing to my spirit. My parents can tell you that for years, and even sometimes now, that every night, as a child when I went to bed, they could hear me sing Silent Night before I went to sleep. I didn't know that. I can't imagine anybody being out of the room, down the hall, in another room, being able to hear. I can't even imagine what it's like for people when they talk and they're not looking at each other, that you can hear what they're saying. That's all beyond my comprehension. So I never dreamed as a child that I was belting out Silent Night every night before I went to bed. My parents were getting a full concert. I'm sure if I knew, I would have been embarrassed. And maybe I wouldn't have sung so loud. But I know I would have still keep singing. Those times were to prepare me in life, and they were hard. I went through first through fourth grade being laughed at and ridiculed in the classroom. I was set in the first row that I'd be able to try to read my teacher's lips. It didn't do too good. Oh, I saw a lot of what she was saying. I saw every question that she asked the students. But you know what? I went through first through fourth grade, my elementary years, by hearing all the questions in life. I never got the answer. Because when she asked that question, some kid in the second or the third or the first row raised his hand, told her the answer, and she responded by saying, "That's right, very good." And I used to think, what was the answer? All those years, I got all the questions, but I never got the answer. It was hard for me to go to school. I didn't want to go to school. First of all, getting all the questions, not getting the answer, being laughed at and ridiculed. And it came to a point where I broke, because these kids no longer just made fun of me when I spoke. They were now waiting for me by the drinking fountain. They were now waiting for me in the playground. They were waiting just to laugh at me. And those times came to a point where they didn't realize that I had three older brothers that had taught me to fight. Yeah, I used to punch them out. And yes, I used to be sent to the principal's office. And this afflicted my wound even greater, because I was sent to the principal's office to be disciplined and to be spanked for punching these guys out. And in my own mind and in my own way, I was being sent to the principal's office and being spanked on top of being laughed at and ridiculed. No one understood. One of the things that saved me during those childhood days was my parents and them trying to instill me to be as normal as possible. I thank God for my mother and the time that she gave, and for my father, all the hours that he worked. You see, I'm standing before you today speaking because of their love and their sacrifice. And I thank God for their lives. I'll never forget going down to Ohio State University, sitting in a classroom with 350-some people, never knowing when even my name was being called, let alone what the professor was saying, and just sitting there. The first semester went by. I was flunking out. And right at the beginning of that second semester, I bumped into a blind guy. And this blind man began to talk with me, and I spoke of my struggles as far as how I was flunking out. And he said, "Well, who's taking your notes for you?" I said, "No one's taking my notes." And he said, "Well, surely you must have somebody that's writing everything down that the professor is saying that you can understand." And he had some friends that was in my classes, and he got them to take notes. And I began to read what was being said. And by then, I had the strength to go to my professors and say, "I'm deaf. I don't understand anything that you're saying in the classroom. Can you help me?" And with that, my professors would hand over to me the entire textbooks that their lecture was based on. So on top of the required reading of maybe 4 and 5 books, I was dumped with 15 to 21 books at a time to read that I had the understanding of what that class was all about. My grades began to rise. It was close enough that I could go and transfer to a small arts school up in Massachusetts. And almost 7 years later, after I started, I graduated with a political science, with a bachelor of science degree. At that time, I thought my problems were over. You see, once you get a college degree, everybody will hire you, right? No, I learned that. I learned that the hard way. From 1976 to 1979, I went from door to door trying to get a job. It would have been okay if I had been refused getting this job because I wasn't qualified or I didn't know. But for every job that I ever went and sought, I was turned down because of one reason and one reason only. I couldn't answer the telephone. And I felt that somebody had to be around, that if the phone rang, that they would be able to answer it. In 1979, I finally went back to the same speech and hearing clinic that taught me to speak. By now, they had moved to Boardman. They were on Market Street. I pounded at the door, asking for a chance to have a job of any sort. They took me in. I became involved with the social services department. And before long, I was working with parents of deaf children, trying to help and counsel and to encourage them. I only lasted there for a little over 6 months. Why, God had other plans for me. Very big, unique plans that I could never have dreamt would have happened. It seems at that same time down in Washington, D.C., the FBI was starting a training program for deaf people. They wanted to train deaf people to search and classify fingerprints. They knew through a friend that I was a deaf person that could read lips, that I had begun to learn signs, and they wanted to know if I was willing to come and be in the first class. Boy, I didn't have to think twice about that. But after being in that training program for 2 weeks, I realized that I had made a very, very big mistake. All you have to do is look at your fingers. And if you look real close at them, you'll see that everyone has a set of fingerprints. And for 8 hours a day, day after day, that's all I was to do, was to look at those prints and to count every one of them. It gets pretty boring. You don't talk to anybody. You just stop there, and you see if it's a circle or if it's a world, and if it's 13 or 21 counts. Believe me, guys, once you've seen one fingerprint, you've seen them all. I could not envision spending the rest of my life retiring looking at fingerprints. And I began to complain and to pray that God would take me out of that situation. And God has a very, very great sense of humor. And he did just that. I asked to be transferred to do anything but counting fingerprints. I could type, and so they put me on the computer typing data into the computer. It was at that time, I remember very well on that given day, that one of the head personnel people came into the office, looked at me and said, "There's some special agents that would like to see you down in the front office. You should go right away." I thought, okay. I had no idea what I was getting into or why they wanted to see me. And the one began to speak and he said, "You know, we understand that you really, really can read lips very good." And I said, "Yes, that's how I communicate. I can't hear. I'm reading your lips." They began to open up with me and share that they had a film that was videotaped of 2 suspects working with an agent on illegal gambling. But they realized that when they brought the tape back to the FBI headquarters, that when the camera activated, the sound mechanism failed. They had all this tape, but they didn't have the slightest understanding of what was being said. They asked me if I would be willing to watch that tape and to tell them what was being said. I said, sure. I never went back to typing on a computer. I never went back to fingerprinting. From that day on, I read lips for the FBI. It was a very unique job. It was very interesting. But because it was so new, because it had never been done before, I couldn't do this 8 hours. There wasn't enough work for me to do. They had to make work up, and they just couldn't do it. And I realize now that I could do and become whatever I wanted to do at the FBI. And so I asked them if I could be a tour guide. Again, they were reluctant because they said, you can't. I said, why? They said, because you have to take 50 people out in groups of tours. You won't be able to understand them. It'll be very hard for me. I kept saying, you'll never know unless you give me a chance. They gave me a chance. I spent the remainder of my days as a tour guide reading lips. I was sitting on top of the world. I was at congressional parties, senators' parties. I met some of the highest-ranking officials of the FBI. I had a good salary. I had everything. But there was a little voice that wouldn't leave me alone on the inside. That was the voice of God that I can tell you indeed that even deaf people cannot annoy this voice. I began to realize that there had to be a lot more to life than just this. But I began to pray that God would take me to where the word was taught. I didn't know that he wouldn't just take me to a church and sit in the church to read the word, that he had other plans to take me to seminary, that this is where I would learn it the best. And I went. And the night that I went, I felt pretty good about myself, thinking I left everything for the sake of God. The next day, I fell flat on my face. Why? Because when word got out that I was deaf on that seminary campus, people started coming to me and saying, you're going to make a great missionary to the deaf. And I kept saying, I'm not going to be a missionary to the deaf. And the more they said it, the louder I shouted it back. And on the inside, there was a struggle that was taking place. You see, I couldn't understand the God who saw all of my tears and frustration as a child, knowing that all I wanted to do was to live and survive in your world, and that I had finally achieved that, would say, okay, Thomas, you made it. Now I want you to go back to the world of silence. For 3 years, God and I wrestled. And those years during seminary were no different than the rest of my life, with the life of alienation, of not understanding. Those were very, very dark days. I did not know how I was even going to begin to get through it. And as I knelt, I read God's word. And he gave me a promise. It was a promise that I would cling to and that I would hold on to for the rest of my life. And I want to share that promise with you now. It's found in the last chapter of Isaiah. And I've taken the name of Israel out, and I've put my name, Thomas, in, because it was his promise to me. And he said, return, O Thomas, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your equanimity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. I will heal your apostasy. I will love you freely, for my anger has turned away from you. I will be like the dew to you, Thomas. You will blossom like the lily, and you will take root like the cedars of Lebanon. Your shoots will sprout, and your beauty will be like the olive tree, and your fragrance like the cedars of Lebanon. Those who live in your shadow will again raise green. Over 5 years ago, he gave me that promise. And I can tell you with all my heart, he kept it. I not only saw the forgiveness of my Heavenly Father for my transgressions and sins. If that wasn't enough, he began to remake me. And if that wasn't enough, he said, okay, Thomas, I'm ready to use you. I spent 2 years of not knowing what God would have for my life. As it turned out, the plan that God had for me was to tell the unfolded story wherever I would go. To say, yes, there is indeed a hope for a bright tomorrow. If you will be still and you will listen, you indeed will hear his truth. And by hearing his truth, you will be free.
You've been listening to a message from Sue Thomas, a woman who has not heard a sound since she was 18 months old. And isn't it interesting, Doctor, that she uses the phrase, you will hear God's message if you just be still.
I don't know if you remember, well, I'm sure you do, Johnny Erickson Tata being in the studio talking about, in fact, she sang about going to heaven and running through the universe someday. And that is the hope of glory that all of us have, that the handicaps and the problems that we have in this world are only temporary. Mm-hmm. Mike, you know what jumps out at me as I listened to that tape was the amount of pain and the amount of rejection and the amount of distress that Sue Thomas went through that was absolutely unnecessary, resulting from people not understanding her problem, not understanding her hearing loss, especially the adults in her life when she was a student in school, allowing other children to fight her and to ridicule her and to hurt her and to attack her. I have said so many times, and it's a passion with me, that as parents, as adults, we must not allow our children to destroy the self-confidence that's there, because that's their natural inclination. With a handicapped child like this, they're like wolves. They will tear a child to pieces in such a way that it will be remembered for a lifetime. And we don't have to permit that. The principal that received her the day that she was fighting those other children should have known that there was something more to that story other than just a girl attacking boys. You know, there should have been more there. We don't know what really happened there, and all we have is Sue's recollection of that. But I have seen adults just stand aside and allow children to do that to one another, and that's where I come unglued as a parent or as an adult. I always look for those opportunities to defend those that are being ganged up on and being taken advantage of. And maybe hearing this tape today will put us into the world of those not only with this handicap, but others, and especially during the early years of childhood. One final thought. There are, as I understand it, 21 million deaf people in the United States. I don't know how many are in Canada, but there are 250 million worldwide. Maybe we can have an authority on hearing loss here in the studio one of these days to see if we can learn a little more about that particular problem.
That's a good idea. Maybe even someone in the listening audience right now could recommend the right person that we contact for that. In the meantime, hopefully just hearing this message today from Sue Thomas has opened the eyes of many of our listeners to just how difficult and how emotionally painful life can be for a deaf person. And this broadcast has been provided by Focus on the Family. Your host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back next time when we'll turn our hearts toward home.